Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, what does a factory mindset have to do with our education system?
It was never about nurturing potential. It was about slotting people, making sure that the average, you know, student has a certain amount of time, and this idea that fast is smart, slow is dumb.
That's today on Inflection Point. The average American gets 6.8 hours of sleep, is middle or working class, and drives 25 minutes to get to work. And we've heard she has an average of somewhere between 1.8 and 2.5 kids. If that statistic has ever bothered you, who has 2.5 kids? Then you might be raising an even deeper question. Why do we rely so much on averages? Our guest, Parisa Ruhani, is the co-founder of the Center for Individual Opportunity. Welcome, Parisa.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the Center for Individual Opportunity. What is it?
In society, we have this basic assumption that people are similar in ways that matter and that they can be understood as a type or a rank or with some kind of a score. So we label people introverts or alpha type or refer to them by some IQ number as though that tells us what we need to know about them. And this leads us to think that we can understand people by comparing them to some average, the average employee or an average student or the average mother. And so what we need to understand is that there is no average person. And we have a science that's kind of shown us that the average is actually a myth. And that when we compare ourselves to average or when we compare people to the average, we're actually missing very useful information about them. So what we're doing at the Center for Individual Opportunity is trying to more than just raise awareness, but convince people to think differently about this idea of average and to replace it with an idea of individuality and thinking about people in an entirely different way.
And what are some examples of ways that you would think about people in an entirely different way?
So the principles of the science, there's three different principles that you can use to think about people. There's the sort of idea of jaggedness, where right now where we collapse people into a category, we think that there's some trait about them. There's something inherent about them, like they're an introvert. And it kind of collapses them into a singular dimension as though they're always this way all the time. But if you think about this principle of jaggedness, you see that, how do you describe it? It's almost like more than just strengths and weaknesses, but that everyone has, you know, different things where they're maybe above average, below average, and those can't be collapsed into a single score. And so if you can see a person with this more sort of dynamic viewpoint, then you can see what would be useful for them. And it's very beneficial for thinking about how to nurture a person or to teach a person or to help a person accomplish anything, really. You need to understand their strengths and their weaknesses and what's unique about them.
What are the other two principles?
There's context and there's pathways. So context is this idea that we're not the same in every situation. And I think everybody, you know that about yourself. So if I were to talk about myself as perhaps like an alpha personality, well, if you put me in the room with a bunch of different alpha personalities, not everyone is going to behave the exact same way. Or if you think about, there's actually this study by Yushi Shoda that shows, for example, aggressiveness. We think of people as either aggressive or not aggressive. But in fact, when he did this study, he videotaped students for, I can't remember, it was like 100 and something hours. And he just watched afterwards, like analyzed the footage of these students. And he came to find that people are different in different contexts. So somebody who might be aggressive in the hallway might be very calm, docile in the cafeteria or in a classroom. And it really depends on the context of the situation. So two people with the same aggression score might be very aggressive in different contexts, and it actually matters where they are and what's going on in that context that makes them behave a certain way. And so those, like, you find these if-then signatures about people that allow you to do something with it instead of just assuming, okay, this person's aggressive or this person's not aggressive. It gives more useful information about what you can do in certain contexts or what kind of interventions you can perform that would help kind of develop strategies or help this person in any kind of meaningful way.
And then the third principle you said is pathways. Tell us about that.
This idea of equifinality, there's always more than one way to get to a given outcome. And right now, we seem to think that there's one best way that works for everybody. But there was actually research that shows, for example, even with reading, there's, you know, three different pathways that people can use to learn to read. Two of them are successful, where you start at different ways and you integrate things at different times, but you get to successful reading, and one is disastrous. But if you think that there's only one progression, one way that you can learn to read, then if somebody is going about it a different way, you think that they need an intervention, when in fact they could be on another completely valid pathway and could be getting toward, you know, successful reading, but now we've intervened in a situation that would have otherwise been fine and kind of creating some kind of a problem where there wasn't one before. And if we don't know the difference, and we don't realize that there is more than one pathway to get to a given outcome, then, you know, we're kind of creating problems where there otherwise wouldn't be.
So I'm so curious how the research gets done, because typically the outcome of a research is that you find something on average is a certain way or not a certain way. So is the research that you're doing showing on average that using averages is a problem? How do you get around that analysis problem?
Well, so right now the way we do is we grab everyone, we do a study, we grab everyone, we aggregate all of the results, and then we see like what we find on average. What's fascinating is there was a study on, I believe it was alcohol consumption, that took a bunch of students, asked them a series of questions about alcohol, like their alcohol consumption, and it found that on average, how early you take your first sip of alcohol was sort of a problematic indicator as you get older. It's like how soon you take your first sip of alcohol. But then when they looked at the different results independently and kind of figured out different ways that this was manifesting in the surveys, they found it wasn't how soon you took your first sip of alcohol. It was how much you took early on, I believe. So it, like, when you look at the research differently, instead of doing a aggregate and then analyze approach, if you first analyze the different results and then you aggregate it based on sort of these clusters or these meaningful patterns that are emerging, you'll actually get more useful information than if you first clump everyone together and then, you know, use that to tell you something meaningful.
So where did this notion of the average person come from?
It's actually really old. It's from the early 1800s. This man, Adolf Ketley, came up with this idea of the average person. He was an astronomer, and he actually used the methods of astronomy and then applied that to thinking about people. And so back in the 1800s, he had to actually do this kind of convincing people that the averages were a useful way of thinking about groups, but it was valid at the time because that's when sort of they were starting to thinking about groups of people and like census taking and looking at society as a whole. And so when you think about averages in terms of like when you get a group of people together and then what that group is going to do, it was useful. So it seemed to be very valid at the time for what it was doing, and it kind of permeated society, where then it kind of took off like wildfire because it was able to tell about groups of people. But then the assumption was ultimately because you can tell us about a group of people, you're able to tell us about the individuals that make up that group, and that's where it falls apart. But nobody really teased that apart. It was just kind of this assumption that if you can understand a group, you can understand the people within the group, but that's not actually true, and now is really the time that we need to start thinking about that.
And was there any relationship between this embracing this idea of averages and the rise of the factory worker and assembly lines and things like that? Is there any connection between what was happening from an industrialization standpoint and this thinking?
Oh, absolutely. So Adolf Ketley from like the early 1800s is the one that came up with like this average man idea. Ketley thought that the average man was this sort of ideal. It was like, you know, perfection. If you take everyone, you come up with this average person, that is like the perfect person. Francis Galton took that same idea of average and said, okay, now we can kind of rank people. You know, average is the middle, and what you really want to strive for is like eminence. You want to be, you know, better than average. And then Frederick Taylor came along and sort of took that idea and applied it to scientific management, into factories, into how do we, you know, like, okay, so if we take these average people, what do we want the average worker to have? And at the time, because it was a sort of industrialized, you know, what we didn't want is people to think for themselves and people to be creative and innovative. We wanted factory workers, people to fit very specific positions that didn't require much thought, because you just want somebody to kind of plug in that job and to be replaceable. It really took off in the sort of industrialization that way. And then Edward Thorndike came along and he applied that same idea to education. And so it was never about nurturing potential. It was about slotting people, making sure that the average, you know, student has a certain amount of time. And this idea that fast is smart, slow is dumb. So if you take all of the students in a class and you just assume that the faster ones are the smarter ones and the slower ones are just never going to get it, so no amount of time is going to help them. And you take how long it takes for them to take an exam or to learn any kind of concept, you get the average of that, and then, you know, that's probably the best for the class because most of the students will get a concept around that amount of time. Anyone who does it quickly, great. Anyone who takes longer is probably not going to understand it. And so that's kind of how we got to the education system that we have right now, and it still is that way. And we still have these like standardized ideas and approaches for how we're going to give exams, how much time we give students to learn, and just the way that we assess the performance is kind of, it's entirely based on that idea, but it is around this industrial model that no longer applies, and yet we still are using it.
And so we've really have entered a new age. So has that been the impetus for why you and the Center for Individual Opportunity feel like we need to be moving away from this notion of the averages?
Absolutely, because right now, back then, we wanted, you know, factory workers, we wanted people to fill jobs, but right now, what we need is innovation. We need people to be thinking in new ways. We need people to be inventing and creating, and that's what we do. Like, that's, you know, what the U.S. is supposedly great for. So this education system that completely doesn't align to what it is that we're hoping is the output, these creative, innovative thinkers, what we need is to nurture the potential of students. And in order to do that, we need to be thinking about students in a different way. We need to be looking at them, not compared to some average or ranking them or sorting them, but really to see what we can do that would help them based on their jagged profiles or based on their sort of strengths and weaknesses and areas that we would better understand if we looked at them instead of this unidimensional ranking.
So, Parisa, who needs to be convinced of this? Who's this message need to get to?
So it's kind of, we have a very big mission, which is to change the way that all of society thinks about this so that the solutions that are built can be seen. Because right now there's a lot of people, even in the space of education, who are doing things that kind of align with the science, but they're seen as one-offs, or they're seen as nice-to-haves instead of something that we absolutely need. And until we can get everyone to, not just stakeholders in education, but really everyone to see things, to see people in a different way, we're not going to be able to embrace or adopt or really demand that these kinds of tools be developed. And we're just going to snap back to the existing way because it's so embedded in our society. And it's kind of a deep-rooted idea that it's hard to get away from because we have had it for so long.
Well, so much of business and identifying market opportunities and institutions rely on averages. They rely on demographics, you know, average age, average income, average education. So are you getting pushback for this thinking, or are you finding acceptance?
Well, so far, the people that we've encountered have really loved this idea. And the only pushback that we get is maybe not a complete understanding of it, because there is this reversion back to, wait a second, but the average does work. I mean, you can use averages for some things. And for some things you can, if you're trying to think about groups, but if you're trying to then apply it to an individual, that's where there's sort of that friction. And because it's such a different idea, it sometimes takes a little while to really understand how badly it's failing at that. And actually, that is why my colleague and co-founder, Todd Rose, wrote an entire book on this. It's because it's kind of a complex idea to understand, but it seems very simple and it seems very intuitive, but that if you think about what it actually means, it has really big implications.
So, Parisa, why is this important to you personally?
I went to 7 different schools before I was in high school, so I've changed schools many times. My family moved around a lot. The difference between how a student or how a teacher sees me when they think about me from this other perspective, because there, you know, there's some good teachers and there's some good pockets of people where, like, this is kind of an intuitive thing in some ways, and they view students a little bit differently. And so for me, I could feel a difference in school growing up between a school that I went to or a teacher that I had who viewed students from this non-standard idea of, you know, what a student should be or comparing a student to an average versus a teacher who kind of understood that comparing us against an average or standardized ideas aren't actually effective in understanding students. And so for me, like, knowing the difference between the experience of that as a student was very valuable for me. And as I got older, I became increasingly interested in learning. And so when I got to graduate school, I was looking at the research about engagement, for example, and working memory. And the more I looked at the literature, the more I realized it's not telling me about any student. It's not telling me about any one person in the study. It's actually telling me about the average of the group. And even in the scientific literature and education, it's still not giving me very useful information. I have to kind of figure that out for myself. If I want to use it, I have to think about sort of how this applies to individuals and what I'm able to get from the literature. And realizing not only how important it is, how it feels different from the student's perspective to be seen one way, and then realizing in the literature that we're not actually understanding as much as we think we're understanding because we're looking at groups, I realized that there is this big disconnect between what we want as a society and what we're actually doing as a society to get there. And so that's why I feel like getting this idea out and making it broad reaching where everyone should, you know, kind of hear it and understand it and come around to it would have the kind of impact that I think would be really meaningful and useful.
Well, you mentioned that you moved around to different schools a lot, and I know that your family left Iran when you were 2. What was going on in the country at the time, and why did you leave?
There was a lot of religious persecution, and my family is Baha'i, and over there right now even, we're, as a Baha'i, we're not allowed to go to school. So, like, even right now, there's sort of underground universities where Baha'is try and get together just to get educated, just to have somebody come and teach, you know, other Baha'is about, for example, engineering or the sciences or whatever, and they get imprisoned for even things like that because they're actively trying to deprive education to the Baha'is in Iran. And so education for me is this very important thing, and not just important, but it's something that I wouldn't get if my family hadn't fled the country. The idea that we have it in the United States, so it's such a important thing to us that it's a compulsory, you know, we expect all students or, you know, all children to go to school until the age of 16, and it's required of all students. It's really a shame that we're not able to get the most out of our students when we really care about that as a society. Whereas, you know, in the society that I come from, I would actively be denied education and imprisoned for trying to get it.
Did your parents get you out of there for that? I'm sure there were many reasons going on, but was that one of the driving reasons for them?
Yeah, for them it was that and, you know, basic living, because they were at that point. So when I was 2 years old, like, my grandfather was martyred. And then my uncle as well, and they were just going through and calling in any of the Baha'is to the courthouse and then detaining us and then keeping them, I think it was my grandfather was there for several months until they, one day my grandmother and family went to go visit him and they, I believe, showed my family his ashes because he wouldn't recant his faith. So for my parents, it was more of a, we should leave or we might not be able to survive any longer sort of situation. But the moving around once we got to the U.S. was for education. It was trying to find the best public school because we couldn't afford private school once we left. So for them, it was they kept trying to find whatever the public school was that was the best for their children. And so we moved seven times before we finally landed in one that they were happy with and comfortable with. And so education is a very important driver for them.
So as far as your experience as a student in public school, finally landing in a situation that felt comfortable, was that just bringing this full circle? Was the way that you were recognized in class living up to this ideal that you're trying to put out there now, this idea of the individual?
So because of my background, because I came from Iran, and I ended up in Arizona, which is, I feel like it's a unique place to grow up. And I never felt like I fit in to begin with. So I always believed that I kind of had to find my own way because the education system wasn't meant for me. So I myself felt like I had to kind of work around it. One salient experience that I'm going to that I'll share with you is when we moved to Brazil for a couple of years when I was, I believe, 6 years old, something around that age. We moved to Brazil for a couple of years and then came back to the United States. And when I came back to the U.S. and I was trying to go back to school, they took me to the front office and they gave me this little exam to see if I knew English words. Now, mind you, before then, I had been living in the United States, so I did know the English words. I was only in Brazil for about 2 years, maybe a little bit less. And they showed me a bunch of flashcards, and I would tell them what picture was on the cards. And I, when they showed me the photo of an ambulance, I couldn't remember the word for ambulance, and I remember calling it medical car. And then somehow I ended up in ESL, so they put this English as a second language class, when English was my absolute favorite class in school, because I loved poetry, I loved, like, stories, and so for them to take me out of English and put me in ESL, because it was literally one mistake that I had made on that one exam, because I know for sure I got everything else correct. That's really when I realized that this system is not going to work for me. I have to figure out my own way around it. So understanding how I'm going to maneuver through the system started early on when I was in elementary school, realizing this isn't going to work. And my parents even, they are not familiar with the American education system, but they had to work with administrators. They did their best to make sure I had the best education, which was phenomenally embarrassing for me because the great lengths they went to was, you know, socially did not make me like the coolest kid in class. But that's when I realized for me that the sort of standard way that it works doesn't work for me, and I am a unique case. And you know, I don't want to say that I'm special, but like in my own head, I was just thinking, okay, I'm not like the average student doesn't apply to me. I'm not going to compare myself to average. I'm not going to try and be average because obviously nothing about my life is like the lives of the people around me. So early on, I kind of had that idea that the average doesn't work for me. And so I think that's the reason that I was able to, you know, make my way around and accomplish the things that I wanted to accomplish instead of being completely held back.
Did anyone give you any great advice on how to do that, on how to stand up for your own individuality, your own individual path?
No. I want to say yes, but I can't say that there was anything very special about it. I know that for myself, I did journal a lot, so I was able for myself to find the sort of patterns of what worked for me, what kinds of situations I thrived in, what kinds of situations weren't so great for me and whatever it was that I was trying to accomplish. And so I think the principles that we have in the science now sort of emerged for me somewhat organically through just my own experiences and writing on them and reflecting on them. But I don't feel like, you know, people should have the crazy life that I had in order to find that. I feel like we have a science and it's, we can see the sort of ways that we could be thinking about this, and maybe it doesn't need to come at such a difficult sort of cost.
Well, Parisa, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and your work with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me.
That was Parisa Rouhani. She's the co-founder of the Center for Individual Opportunity and is studying issues at the intersection of neuroscience, design, and technology at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. That's our inflection point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. And while you're there, I invite you to become a patron of Inflection Point, like Ellen Weinreb and the Perkins Fund, who are helping bring the voices and views of powerful women to the ears of everyone. And you can too at inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.